Nagant levor ver, Gheorghi sugare. dušmani ne se predade.
Thank you.
Zdravo, vidam babo mori.
continuum. That period of U.S. history included the second half of four decades of radical immigration restrictions. Since 1975, efforts have been made to research and disseminate non-English language music produced in the U.S. during the first half of the 20th century. However, these efforts have had little impact on reshaping the broader cultural consciousness, both within the United States and abroad, about the vitality of multicultural, multi-ethnic America. As a result, the prevailing image remains one of an America divided simply into black and white, Christian and Jewish, overlooking the significant contributions that connect it to a wider world and leaving indigenous peoples nearly invisible on the cultural record. Don't know if you know John Cage's diary, How to Improve the World, You'll Only Make Matters Worse. It's fantastic. But it's made of these little poetry, little haiku bits of observations and ideas. One of them, he points out, the absurdity that when a person goes to college, they go to a class, and the class assigns, say, 200 people in the class to read one book, when in fact, 200 people can read 200 books in that same amount of time. But it is the fact that we build canons. We tell one story over and over and over again. And those stories that we Americans keep telling about ourselves over and over and over again are how we have instilled across 10 million square kilometers and within 340 million people this repeated sense of American identity. It's a systemic failure of the U.S. to perceive itself accurately, originating in centuries of underlying prejudices about the relative values of human life among people of differing socio-ethnic economic identities. These have been expressed in legal terms, who could and should be included as American. But parallel cultural work operating on several levels has functionally diluted both the majority of Americans and many others to whom we have exported our self-image through our massive media output. Movies, books, music, all that stuff. So we'll start then. It has become fashionable in America to do a land use recognition at the beginning of a talk. We are not on American soil today, so instead I will quote from Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1963 book, Why We Can't Wait. Our nation was born in genocide when it embraced the doctrine that the original American, the Indian, was an inferior race. Even before there were large numbers of Negroes on our shores, the scar of racial hatred had already disfigured colonial society. From the 16th century forward, blood flowed in battles of racial supremacy. We are perhaps the only nation which has tried as a matter of national policy to wipe out its indigenous population. Moreover, we elevated that tragic experience into a noble crusade. Indeed, even today, we have not permitted ourselves to reject or feel remorse for this shameful episode. Our literature, our films, our drama, our folklore, all exalt it. It so happens that in the decade following the Second World War, 1945 to 55, one-third of Hollywood's productions were Westerns, which are, over and over again, this image of the pioneer moving west to contend with nature, of which the people who were living there were one part. So folklore as a field, as a study, starts in kind of Northern Europe in the 19th century and is tied to all kinds of nationalist impulses. And within only a decade or two, it takes root in America in academia. And one of the first things that people learning the discipline of folklore did was to apply it to Native Americans. There was a guy at Harvard, a zoologist named Jesse Walter Fuchs, and a guy from Cornell who dropped out named Hamilton Cushing, who worked in the Zuni Pueblo making cylinder recordings in the 1890s. Right at the same time, Benjamin Ives Gilmore, a New Yorker with degrees from Harvard and Johns Hopkins, took advantage of the many Native cultures coming and being represented at the Columbia World's Exposition, 1893 in Chicago, where he made cylinders of musicians from Fiji, Java, the Ottoman Empire, and elsewhere, including indigenous peoples from British Columbia and the American Northwest. That period is right when disc recording really kind of takes off. The last decade of the 19th century through, you know, the beginning of the 1920s is this exponential growth of commercial sound recording. It was also the low ebb of indigenous population in the United States. We, Americans, killed 96% of all Native people. There were only 250,000 Native people left in the United States about 1900. There are now only about 3 million. And they have a very peculiar legal status. Some are citizens, many are not. They are dependent states' wards. They are stateless people. Okay, so during this period of exponential growth, one of the things that does not get recorded, really, is Native people. There are exceptions, which are interesting. 1904, an Iroquois singer named Honuses, whose name I'm certainly pronouncing wrong, recorded 12 7-inch one-sided discs for Victor Records. There is only one complete run of them that I know of. It was dealt by a dealer friend of mine for $12,000 to an institution's library. They sold so poorly or were pressed in such minuscule quantities that there's only this one set of them left that we know of. Victor Records, there are two major record companies in the United States before the Second World War, Victor and Columbia. I'm going to be referring to them periodically, so. Victor Records was the more prestigious of the two, and Victor rejected all further trial performances cut by other Indian performers until the mid-1920s, when they issued three discs during that period, 1917 to 1924, by a Penobscot singer named Lucy Poulaw under her stage name Princess Wadawahu. Accompanied by performers on Western instruments, including a guy with a complicated relationship to Native populations who was a composer named Thurlow Lawrence, born 1878, died 1963. Anyway, she released six sides, but she recorded a total of 28 sides. All the rest, those other 22, were rejected for release by Victor Records, and those were her singing with Western musical instrument accompanists. Indian music on commercial discs was made at two performances cut by Columbia, June 23rd, 1913, by an anonymous group of Seneca Indians, issued as part of an educational series. I'm going to play you one of those sides. The deal is with this record that it was said for a while that these were members of a touring theatrical troupe run by a guy named Wild Bill Cody, who did a Buffalo Bills stage show. They were not, at the time of this record, part of that stage show, but it's possible that some of the people were old enough to have been part of his stage show a decade or two earlier. Instead, we know that there was a Seneca performance of a play in New York City right about the time this record was made, summer 1913. We suspect that it was actors in that stage show that made this record. The deal was it was made for Columbia. So Victor's the more prestigious label. Columbia is competing with Victor constantly. And one of the ways they competed with Victor was they would take on all comers if you pay in advance. You could buy your way in to Columbia's catalog. If you want to make a record, and they actively went to churches and social organizations and rich people and said, we'll make records for you, you just pay us $50 or whatever and we'll press them up and da da da. It so happens this record from 1913 coincides with the translation and publication in English of the Code of Handsome Lake. Handsome Lake was a visionary prophet of the Seneca people who in 1799 founded the Longhouse religion. And his work was translated by a guy named Arthur Caswell Parker, born in 1881, died 1955, who's a folklorist of American Indian culture, whose father was half Seneca and had taken an interest in this stuff. In 1913, he takes up a whole issue of an educational journal in New York State dedicated to Handsome Lake and the Longhouse religion. So I believe that what's going on with this Seneca record is that it was a personal project of his, that he paid Columbia Records to press these up. They circulate pretty frequently. One side was a children's chorus. I am told anecdotally that it is them singing the catechism. This side is just labeled funeral chant. And I was in Buffalo, New York 10 years ago or so, gave a talk at a bookstore, was chatting with an older fella, and said, it's interesting, there's still Seneca people around here. There were at the time only 100 speakers of the Seneca language left. It's all indigenous languages are endangered. Seneca is going away fast. And I said, yeah, I'd really love to get this one Seneca record translated sometime. And he said, oh, yeah, I speak Seneca. I was like, you're not Seneca, though, right? No. I've just, kind of spent most of my life hanging out in bars. So I picked a lot up. Okay, I've got a copy of it. Do you want to go out to my car and listen? Yeah, sure, great. So I put on this track. And he goes, oh, yeah, funeral song. Oh, yeah, I know this melody. And then he laughs and he goes, heh, what's funny? And he goes, the words are gibberish. They're not real words. They replaced all the actual Seneca words with nonsense so that, people outside wouldn't get access to the text. So that apparently, I'm told, this guy who just says that he picked up Seneca in bars, I don't know, but it's a beautiful little record. So apart from that one, apart from that little run of 1904 7-inch discs, there was also a disc credited to the Glacier Park Indians with a vocalist called Blackfoot, made for Victor in 1914, stayed in print off and on for decades. And there was a string band in Texas, Big Chief Henry's Indian String Band, recorded for Victor in 1929. But otherwise, a dozen or so discs were issued by Jennett, a few smaller labels in the mid-20s. There are basically a total of a few dozen recordings of Native Americans made before 1940. After 1940, a couple little independent labels sprung up as part of the Taos scene. Taos, New Mexico was this kind of artsy hippie colony. Georgia O'Keeffe, those people. And so there was some stuff that came out of that, this Candelero label run by a guy who was a dealer, an antique dealer, a hustler who was selling Indian stuff to non-Indian people. And then in 1950, Canyon Records was founded by Indians for Indians. And Canyon Records is still in business. It is one of the oldest running independent labels in the world, as a matter of fact. And very early on in their run, they recorded a bunch of sides by a guy named Chief Nate. Edward Lee was his other name, who was born about 1910. And he made eight sides. And then his wife recorded one side. And his wife is not Chief Nate's wife. His wife is Pop Chaley, who you may not know about, but is one of the most wonderful painters of the 20th century in the United States. She was a very famous artist during the 1940s, 50s, 60s. Pop Chaley, her name means blue flower, was born in Utah March 20th, 1906. Her father was from Taos, Puebla, and she moved back there with him when she was 14. Her mother was from Bern, Switzerland. And when she went back to visit her mother slammed the door on her and called her a terrible name. And she never saw her again. When her mother died, in fact, in the 1960s, her obituary mentioned five children. Pop Chaley was not one of them. Her mother totally disowned her. But anyway, yeah, so she went on to become this great painter. And she recorded just this one record in about 1951, 52 for Canyon. I just happened to like it and thought you would want to hear it. So here she is. It's just credited as a Tiwa love song. We okay? Oh, dear. Pardon me? I'm going to try this again because that's a problem. Take two. Still problem. I beg your pardon. I'm so sorry about that. That's really unfortunate. Oh dear. All right. Well, onward. Life goes on. And if I play the next track, it sounds like. That's not good either. Are you guys okay? Am I hurting you by doing that? I'm so sorry. All right, I'm doing my best here. Yeah, we'll figure it out. Okay, so, golly, what in the world just happened? Wow, that's too bad, isn't it? Okay, so what I'm playing for you next was an instance of an ethnographer that I want to talk to you about. You see that, this whole business of studying native music goes on all through the 20th century, and you wind up with a whole bunch of interesting people coming out of Columbia University, in particular Franz Boas is sort of one of the founders of anthropology generally, and he trains Margaret Mead and Zora Neale Hurston. But other people who were taking an interest in recording and studying American Indian music include all these names that you probably may not have encountered. Matilda Cox Stevenson, Helen Heffron, Alice Cunningham Fletcher, Eliza Clues Parson, Constance Goddard Dubois, Natalie Curtis Berlin, Helen Hartness Flanders, Gladys Amanda Reichert, Theodora Kroeber. You notice a pattern here? It's a lot of women. It's a lot of women. And we've never heard of any of them, right? Another one is Frances Densmore. And Frances Densmore recorded really prolifically over 40, 50 years. Some of that material, it's all in the Library of Congress, and you can listen to it there. Some of it was released on LP in the 1950s. But generally speaking, people only know, there's a photo of Francis Densmore playing a recording back for a guy in full regalia that you see sometimes. The band Magic Hour used it on the cover of a 7-inch back in the 90s. Anyway, it's a thing you see, but Francis Densmore's name you don't hear very much. Just as you may not hear the name Laura Bolton very much. Laura Bolton. Does anybody know Laura Bolton? No? Okay, good. Laura Bolton was a farm girl from Conneaut, Ohio. She was born in 1899, and she was trained. I mean, you know, her family had this farm for, you know, 70 years, something like that, way up on Lake Erie. And they spent a huge amount of money on the training of her voice. She could read music before she could read words. She sang in operettas, she had solos at the age of 3. She said that when she was a little girl, she used to pray every night, "Dear God, please make me a high soprano." So everybody thought she was going to be a singer. And she went to college. And after college, she graduated and she wound up marrying this guy who was an ornithologist. His name was Rudyard Bolton. And Rudyard Bolton was involved with these prestigious museums who were involved in what all prestigious museums were doing at the time, which was going around to the colonies, the British, French, Belgian, Dutch colonies, and snatching and grabbing stuff for their collections. So I guess his first trip was to West Panama, actually, in 1924. But then he goes to Angola in 1925. 1929, there's a big trip that's funded by this very wealthy one percenter, she said, with hand gestures, and record herself singing it. And then she plays it back for them, and they go, "Oh, wait, that's your voice. That's what you just sang." And she goes, "Right, that's what it does. It remembers and says it back." And they go, "Oh, I want to do that. Can I do that?" "Yes, you can do that." And people gather around, and she learns how to get people to sing and play for her. And it's fun, and she's there to learn and make little friendships. And because she's a musical person, she can learn tunes and sing along with them, which then makes them friends. Now, okay, is she paying anybody for any of this? No. But she comes back. They're living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania at this time. And the newspapers go, "Oh, you guys were away for 11 months, academic couple. What did you think of Darkest Africa?" And Laura Bolton says, "It is such a bummer coming back to the United States. If I can't go back to Africa, I think I would rather die." And this is not what anybody expected to hear at all. So Laura Bolton realizes there's something to do here, and she goes again with them 6 months later, another big trip to Angola for 6 months, and she records there really prolifically now on the wax cylinder machine. And then another trip, she gets funding from the Carnegie Corporation and from this woman, Laura Strauss, who's the widow of a diplomat. And she gets a custom-made disc cutting machine that runs on a battery and cuts into aluminum plates. And she spends 8 months, over 8,500 miles, all through West Africa, just recording on these aluminum plates. And it's... they start in what's now Senegal, and then it's through Mali, Nigeria, Togo, Benin. I think that might be nearly all the countries, or I might be forgetting one. But then she comes back to the United States, and she's got all these recordings. She has already started giving little talks to like women's organizations and things, explaining, showing pictures, slides, movies that they're taking of people playing and stuff, and playing these wax cylinder recordings. Now she has this arsenal of more than 300 discs that she's made on this one big recording trip. And she's playing these recordings and explaining to people that this music is, as she put it, above our scope, she says. Just as our... Okay. In 1937, the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper, black newspaper in Baltimore City,